big fan by Santa Ana winds, and people could not get out of their homes fast enough. Currently, there have been 20 structures destroyed, 12 structures damaged, and the fire continues to move west towards the cities of Oceanside and Camp Pendleton. But tonight is one of those nights, today is one of these fires that people need to be ready, because this fire could make it all the way through Oceanside to the coast.
CAL FIRE Division Chief Nick Schuller last night when the Lilac Fire broke out in San Diego County. So far, it has burned more than 4,000 acres. It's among the half dozen fires devastating Southern California this week. More than 140,000 acres have been burned. Today, we're going to check in on the worst of them. The Thomas Fire in Ventura has spread to Carpinteria, where residents there received evacuation warnings last night. KCRW's own Jonathan Bastian was one of them. He's sheltering now at our Santa Barbara station, and he joins us from there. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
All right. What is the status of this fire right now?
Yeah, I mean, the status is that it just continues to move up the coast. It's interesting. You know, I started this week reporting down in Ventura, and I thought I could stay down there. Then the next day, I was in Carpinteria, and now I'm up in Santa Barbara because I'm essentially just trying to stay ahead of the flames. This is an area where the mountains essentially just go down and reach the ocean, so it's burning along these hillsides and these mountainsides. And the fear right now is that this fire is sitting basically on the border of Santa Barbara County and Ventura County. And if it moves any further right now, it will go into the residential areas of Carpinteria. So they are trying to stop this fire where it is right now, and that's what we're going to hope happens over the next day or two.
Right. And when you evacuated yesterday, were you prepared? Did you have to leave really quickly?
Yeah, you know, who really is prepared when these things happen? Right. You think you are, right? It's a pretty incredible moment, especially as a reporter. I've been covering people that have been evacuating, and then suddenly to get that alert on my phone, I ran home with my girlfriend. My dad met us there, and there we are, like, sorting through family stuff in about an hour or two. And you just ask yourself, what do you take with you? It's a really kind of heavy process. I have a lot of empathy for the people that have been dealing with this over the last weeks right now, and we could do a whole show on what you take with you, Madeline, yeah. Honestly. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. So,
right. Okay. So meanwhile, the air quality is just terrible. People are wearing gas masks or some kind of masks on their faces.
Yeah, we got an alert from the county here in Santa Barbara saying that the air is just not safe. There's a lot of particulates out there right now. And yesterday, amazingly, they handed out about 35,000 masks. They ran out at one point. And you walk around here and it's like we're in like downtown Beijing or New Delhi right now. I mean, just really heavy smog that's settled down all over the coast. And people are wearing them. And it's a very eerie feeling right now, especially up here in Santa Barbara, where a lot of kind of evacuees are coming up here. And some people are saying, actually, I'm going to San Luis Obispo. I'm going to Pismo Beach just to get out of all the smoke that is just sitting down right now over the coastline.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Ventura. This was the most hardest hit. They lost about 430 structures, I believe.
Yeah.
And then the fire was almost up to the city hall steps, right? And
oh, this was unbelievable. This is actually where I began my week, was covering some of the houses that got burned right around there. I mean, you could just see city hall just you know, not that far away. And luckily, they were able to contain it just in time. I mean, it's a similar case in Ojai. The fire came to within miles of downtown Ojai. They were able to stop it there. And so, I mean, the big question right now is what do we do about rebuilding? And this is a really interesting question in the city of Ventura, because at the moment, we have to deal with a lot of displaced people, right? Potentially thousands. And this is an area, like a lot of coastal California and LA, that's in the middle of a housing crisis. I mean, mm-hmm. there's virtually no housing stock available for people to move into in terms of long-term rentals. So, I mean, question A, where do you go live in the meantime? Question B, we're talking a year to 2 years to even rebuild your home. And so this is one of those moments, right, Madeline, where you have all these problems kind of compounding at the same time, you know, fire plus housing crisis equals what do we do?
And plus drought on top of it.
Oh,
and Santa
sure.
Barbara especially hard hit by drought. They were re-upping the desalination plant. Are they talking about that?
Yeah, so the desal plant has actually been pumping up here, and it's been providing quite a bit of water to the city. It could potentially at some point provide 100% of the water. And that's part of a bigger question here, is that this is an area that even though it did get a lot of rain, it kind of still remained in drought. And I think one of the most interesting things I've learned about this region is that one reason that these bushes and these mountains and these hills burn so fast is because last year we got all this rain, but then it just just stop. So we had all this vegetation growth in the hills. And then it all dried out, right? So once this thing sparked, it was like adding so much fuel to the fire. And I've spoken to a lot of meteorologists, and they don't anticipate any rain coming because of La Nina right now. And so we could potentially be looking at a fire season that could easily continue into January, potentially into 2018 as well.
All right. KCRW's Jonathan Bastian, thanks for your reporting, and take care of yourself.
Thank you, Madeline.
Okay, the Weinstein-esque allegations continue to drop, making waves in Congress and in Hollywood. But one so-called open secret has managed to escape a lot of scrutiny until now. A man named Cesar Sanchez Guzman is suing X-Men director Bryan Singer for sexual assault. He says Singer raped him at a yacht party when he was 17 years old, about a decade ago. He said Bryan Singer told him he could give him a Hollywood career if he kept quiet. This is not the first lawsuit accusing Bryan Singer of abuse. For two decades, he has been accused of assaulting underage men. Just listen to this Family Guy clip from 2 years ago.
You see, Stewie, there are tons of actors like this. They all started out just like you, but eventually they were destroyed by their parents' greed, drugs, or perverted Hollywood directors.
Oh, like Bryan Singer.
Okay, that's from Family Guy. Dana Harris is the editor-in-chief of IndieWire, and she's been reporting on this. Hello.
Hi.
All right, let's talk about this current lawsuit. You spoke with the plaintiff, and what did he tell you?
He couldn't go into great detail about the case, but what he wanted to make clear was that he felt empowered by being able to come out with this, and that he was greatly encouraged by the number of lawsuits and accusations that have been leveled at other people in Hollywood that have made him feel like he could have a chance to have his voice out.
So the Harvey Weinstein effect.
Yeah, the Harvey Weinstein effect.
Yeah. And so, but in the complaint mm-hmm. itself is pretty
brutal.
Yeah, detailed. And we don't want to go into the more, vivid incidents.
Yeah, not for a family radio show.
He recounts, but he's talking about rape.
Yeah, he's talking about rape. And the way he positioned it to me, because I asked him about the actual incident, he said that he knew the owner of the yacht, a tech guy named Lester Waters, and had been there before and was invited back and was introduced to Bryan Singer on the yacht. And he said maybe an hour or two after that, Bryan pulled him into a bedroom and assaulted him.
And this yacht, this was in the Seattle area?
This is in the Seattle area, yeah.
Okay, and this was about 10 years ago?
This is 2003, I think, so it's even longer.
And he felt he couldn't come forward until
now. Yeah, he felt like he couldn't come forward. And again, I tried to ask details about that, but again, because they've just filed a lawsuit, they're pretty stingy with the details.
All right. And so, but you looked back, there have been other lawsuits.
There's been many lawsuits. And we started working on this timeline about 2 weeks ago, just on general principle. Just because the question we kept hearing was, what about Bryan Singer? What about Bryan Singer? And the reason people ask that is because it's been a question multiple times. There's been many times when there have been lawsuits and that there have been questionable onset behavior. So it's, when he was fired from Bohemian Rhapsody on Monday, what I started thinking was, this is not that crazy of a thing to happen to him. I mean, it's very crazy as a thing to happen in Hollywood. Directors are almost never fired. I mean, with the exception of like
the
Star Wars.
And what was the official reason given?
The official reason given was basically going AWOL.
He didn't show up.
He didn't come back to the set after Thanksgiving.
Oh.
Yeah.
And do we think that this is connected?
No, I actually don't think it's connected. I mean, it's like, or if it is, it's in some kind of very distant way. It's not like, lawsuit happened, therefore we were doing this. I don't think. Because it's like he really was gone.
Yeah.
And that's basically, I think, a director being gone is like, a captain abandoning a ship. You can't do that.
So several years ago, there was a lot of news about this Michael Egan lawsuit that mm-hmm. was filed, and then it was withdrawn.
Yes, and then it was withdrawn, and then he was imprisoned on a completely separate charge.
Michael Egan was.
Yeah. And that's the thing that makes this all so confusing, and one of the things we tried...
A fraud case.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And one of the things we tried to do in the timeline was to include everything in terms of the what Singer's team would say in response, what happened to the lawsuits, so that it's clear, like, this is not easy to parse.
So how many men have accused him of sexual assault?
Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Five,
clearly. There's Justin Smith, the guy who had a Twitter going on saying about that he assaulted me, but then he took it down. There was John Doe number 117, who said that Singer assaulted him in the UK during the Superman Returns premiere. There was, gosh, who am I forgetting? Oh, gosh. Well, Alexander Burton was an X-Men actor, but he didn't actually file against Bryan Singer. That was against the founders of the Digital Entertainment Network, in which were intimates of Bryan's.
Right. And so tell us a little bit about that, this Digital Entertainment Network, because this is a place that would host these parties where often underage boys would be.
Yeah, Digital Entertainment Network was sort of YouTube before there was YouTube. It was ahead of its time in terms of trying to get video content for young audiences on the web. But it was also sort of a case study in a dot-com bubble and people spending insane amounts of money for nothing. And they became infamous for having crazy, crazy parties at their house. And one of the founders of Digital Entertainment Network, Michael Collins Rector, was eventually found guilty of transporting minors for the purpose of sex and is now a registered sexual offender.
And the connection to Bryan Singer is?
The connection to Bryan Singer is, in addition to him attending their parties, he introduced one of their co-founders to them, Brock Pierce, and he also was a minor investor in Den as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so what does his lawyer say about all these allegations?
It says that they're completely false, that he will be countersuing, that he will pursue this to the ends of the earth, that, give no quarter.
Right. Okay. And so... as we've said, these allegations have been around for a while, and they've made news, and then they've not made news.
Right.
And now they're making news again. What do you make of that, the fact that Bryan Singer was, until recently, still being hired to direct major Hollywood movies with all these allegations floating around?
I think you have to look at the way the culture is now and was then. And by then, I mean 2 months ago. I mean, it really has completely changed. One of the things that I think is really significant in the Weinstein allegations is that there was recently a class action lawsuit filed against him and against the Weinstein Company for essentially creating an environment where this was allowed to happen. To me, that lawsuit's really interesting because it really puts any corporation on notice in terms of housing somebody who they believe is capable or not capable, who has done sexual assault. Because it means that they can be liable. And I have to believe that that is going to affect things going forward. I have to believe that's going to, whatever happens with this lawsuit with Singer, I have to believe that's going to affect consideration of him going forward as well. I mean, it's the balance for them is that he's a $1 billion director. He's a multi-billion dollar director. He's executive producer of House. He's executive producer of Legion in addition to the X-Men. And so, yeah, he's had this track record of being unreliable and flaky on sets. And yes, there's been these assault charges, but they got dismissed. It's been I'm sure to the studio, it's like, okay, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But even, Fox even told him before going to London for Bohemian Rhapsody, basically, you'd better behave. And, so it's like his reputation preceded him. One case I wanted to point out that I thought was really interesting because I'd completely forgotten about it was the John Doe in the UK with Superman Returns. The John Doe accused Singer and Gary Goddard of assaulting him. Gary Goddard is the same person that Anthony Edwards recently came out against, saying that that was his assaulter.
Oh, wow.
And who others have come out to say that recently as well. And Gary Goddard's now stepped down from his massive entertainment design firm.
All right. So the story will definitely be continuing. It definitely has legs. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Dana Harris. She's the editor-in-chief of IndieWire. Coming up, is LeVar Ball ruining his son's basketball careers? We'll talk about that with the Sklar brothers next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
It sure does. You know what that means? Sklar time. Sklar Brothers are here to talk sports. Hi, you guys.
Yay.
Hi, Madeline.
It's nice to be back. It is a crazy sports time.
It is a crazy sports time.
Sure.
And let's talk about the family ball.
The family ball. That could be a show, right? LeVar Ball, the dad. Who...
Yeah, the list of characters, please.
I'm sure he wants a show. Yes.
He wants,
so LeVar is the father.
Lonzo is the oldest son who plays on the Lakers, and he's
right.
actually doing better than people thought.
Better than people expected.
And then you've got LiAngelo, who basically perpetrated the
shoplifting in China.
The UCLA guy.
He was on UCLA, then suspended indefinitely, and then his dad's pulling him off the team. And then you've got LaMelo, who scored
100
points in a high school game.
Wow.
He played for Chino Hills, although his father has pulled him out of Chino Hills and started homeschooling him.
Now he's talking about pulling him out of homeschool,
which are you
protesting your own house?
How do you
do that?
How do you do that?
So he wants to pull both of the younger kids out and take them to Europe to have them play professionally in Europe, which
a lot of people are saying you're underestimating how difficult it is to play in Europe. You're a high school kid living on your own. Usually you need a parent to go over there.
Well, that's why LeVar's going to go with him, right?
Which for the Lakers, they're kind of like,
go, please, get
to Europe.
Go to Greece.
Because I don't know if you heard about this, but
Europe isn't far enough.
Isn't far enough, but they said to LeVar Ball, they put like a media ban on LeVar Ball at Staples Center. Like you can't, the media cannot talk to LeVar Ball, which we say is kind of the wrong approach with LeVar Ball, because
that's just egging him on.
That will only get him to say,
like he's sort of handling the media by himself. Like he has that new tweet where he is tweaking the president.
Dunking on Donald Trump.
Yeah,
well, it's amazing.
A
that's a whole other thing, and we can talk about that, because his interaction with Trump is, to us,
hilarious,
because he's the one guy on Twitter who plays the Twitter game like Trump. He goes at him in the same way with no facts, and just he makes up his own truth. He says whatever he wants to
say. Like Trump is saying, I was responsible for getting your kid out of the China situation.
Without me, your kid doesn't come home from China. And
LeVar Ball's response is, Trump who?
Trump who?
Who are you?
No, you didn't. I'm the one who got the people out. So he's taking credit for it. It's so funny because it gets under Trump's skin so much that part of us wants the Democrats to like cart LeVar Ball out as the candidate, because that debate I would watch. Trump, LeVar Ball would be an unbelievable, because he claims that LeVar claims he's never lost at anything ever, and he would, of course, win.
So basically, LeVar 2020 is
LeVar 2020.
Saying.
Maybe we're starting.
So
ultimately, for his kids, this decision to take them to Europe, though, is pretty. It's a difficult decision, and we don't agree with it. We feel like it's definitely going to hurt their development as players.
Well, here's the deal, and what we've learned about the European League and what the European League has become recently is that it's very difficult for coaches to develop players there because they have to win right now.
Or they
lose their job. So much is at stake that the coaches will not take a player like LiAngelo, who is 6'5". He's not really a really tall power forward.
Shoots about 30% from
32% from the field. He's not great from three-point range, so he needs to be developed. Well, no European team is going to say, we're going to develop this kid and potentially lose some games just to develop him, because you start losing in the European League, you're gone. Your job is done. So LiAngelo wasn't even playing on UCLA.
He was a bench player.
He was a bench player there. So
Before the whole China thing. Well,
and by the way, China could have been an option if you didn't shoplift over there.
Yeah.
So now China is not an option.
Well, so UCLA is saying what?
I think they're more disappointed at the potential of losing the youngest Ball son, who had potential certainly as a scorer on par with Lonzo Ball, who made UCLA great. I'd say for the middle son, they could take it or leave it.
Okay. We actually have a clip of tape of both LiAngelo and LeVar speaking about this decision to leave UCLA on the Today Show.
I'm going to get Jello in shape. I'm going to work him out. We're going to do some other things, and he's going to be headed to the NBA. All these boys are going to get on the Lakers. Watch how I do this. And people are going to look up, and they say, wow, how they all get on the Lakers.
I just want to play, period. I mean, I'm not worried about money. And playing with Zoe and Melo, or playing with my brothers in L.A., that's like paying me right there, really, just being able to play with them.
So that's the plan. The three of them will be on the Lakers playing together.
That's very difficult to do. All of them need development. All right, Lonzo's going to get development on
the
court, in the league. That's just, you know, the Lakers have said we will lose with him as he develops, okay? And maybe we'll get better. And I have to say, the Lakers aren't terrible this year, and there's hope. But these other kids have to be developed. They're not even close to where
Lonzo was, even when Lonzo was a freshman at UCLA.
So I don't see how that's going to happen. That, to me, is a pipe dream. And again, you know, LeVar Ball's a big talker because he's got this. Every time he talks, every time even Trump tweets at him,
it winds up being great advertising for his big baller brand of shoes and clothes and athletic wear. And so you take everything he says with not just a grain of salt, but
is that literally the name of the clothing brand?
Big Baller. Big Baller. So the thing is,
I get it.
A grain.
I love that you explained that to Madeline.
I wouldn't say just a grain of salt, but like take an entire salt mine. Crazy. Crazy.
Crazy. Is there anything else we need to talk about?
We'll talk about the Rams briefly because they are the Rams and the Chargers, both teams in LA, football teams in LA. Everyone thought that the Rams, it would take them a few years to get good.
Wade Phillips, who's the defensive coordinator. Every team he's gone to in the first year that he's joined that team has made the playoffs. And people told him, look, you might break your streak this year with the Rams. Not true.
Rams may be the best team.
So they're leading their division.
In the NFC. They're leading their division.
They're ahead of Seattle.
They're ahead of Seattle. Now, Seattle's coming on, and Seattle has Russell Wilson, who's probably the best quarterback, at least the most valuable player on any team because most offense goes through him. But I got to say, I watched the Rams. Jared Goff, who is playing out of his mind. He's a great quarterback. The defense is great. Todd Gurley is healthy. This Rams team is fun. They're exciting. I can't believe they're this good this fast. And the Chargers, who started off terribly, they were like, what,
0-5,
0-5, whatever they were terrible in their division. And Kansas City looked like they were going to run away with it. Kansas City has now fallen way back down to earth. And Oakland, the Chargers, and Kansas City are all 6-6. And the Chargers are playing the best out of all of them. So you could see the Chargers
and the Rams perhaps making the playoffs.
Truthfully, now you have to ask yourself, who do you root for?
Chargers.
Who do you guys root for?
I think we're more Rams just because the Rams came to St. Louis and we're also from St. Louis. Rams have a rich tradition here. In our minds, we thought the Chargers should have perhaps almost done what the Angels kind of are, you know,
and go to build a stadium down by the big, you know, where the
big
Angels
A in
play.
Anaheim, mm-hmm. and call them the SoCal Chargers. Then you could have pulled the same fans from San Diego. They still would have supported. And if you want to be a fan from LA or Orange County, you could have gone down to support them.
But they didn't do that. No one listened to us.
I don't know why.
I guess our last name should be Ball. Maybe they'll listen to us at that point.
Okay. Randy and Jason Ball.
Ball. See, we did it to you.
Sklar, Ball, there's similarity
close.
There.
Yeah.
Randy, Jason, Sklar. They are the comedy team, the Sklar Brothers. Check out their podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Coming up, this week's new movies, including I, Tonya, a feature film about 90s skater Tonya Harding.
It is darkly funny, and it's often very, very dark, and it has a great energy about it, but you walk away with this really unexpected sense of sympathy for Tonya Harding.
And a review of Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, time for movie reviews. Christy Lemire is here. She is co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Hey there.
Hello. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And Russ Fisher, editor-in-chief of MoviePilot.com. Hey, Russ.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, let's begin with Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water.
We're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
When he looks at me, he does not know how I am incomplete.
Okay, he being the creature from the Black Lagoon.
He looks just like him. He looks like a very high-tech, very elaborate version of the creature from the Black Lagoon. And there are a lot of classic movie touchstones here, but that's only one element of how this movie is just like swooningly romantic and so beautifully conceived. It's like the ultimate Guillermo del Toro film in that it's a fairy tale and it's romantic and lush, but there's a darkness and there's a danger beneath it at all times. And the fantastical creature here is just meticulously designed and rendered, and you really feel for that love affair between him and Sally Hawkins. It's just beautiful.
Okay, so give us a quick plot synopsis.
Okay, so Sally Hawkins is this mute janitor at this secret Cold War era government facility, and one day the bad guys bring in this creature to analyze it, to study it, whatever, and she forms this incredible emotional connection with it because they just, they communicate without words. They understand one another. And it reminds me of E.T. in that regard, in that somebody very sensitive connects with this creature that is misunderstood, and their bond, like, you know, will it withstand the test of time? Anyway, incredible supporting cast, including Octavia Spencer, Michael Stuhlbarg, Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins is her gay best friend. And it's this band of outsiders who come together to free this creature.
And Russ, most of it, or most of that relationship, is wordless.
It is, yeah, and it's remarkable. Sally Hawkins is phenomenal in this role, playing a mute character. And then Doug Jones, who's a Guillermo del Toro regular, he played the Pale Man in Pan's Labyrinth and the Fawn in Pan's Labyrinth, and he's in most of Guillermo's movies now. And the two of them create this, exactly what Christy said, this bond in this communication that is almost entirely nonverbal, and it's swooningly gorgeous. It's really wonderful. But also, you're highlighting the romance of the movie and their connection. It's also a very sexual movie, which is kind of surprising.
Isn't the creature in a tank?
The creature is originally in a tank, and then it's eventually not in the tank.
Oh.
But there's a very frank sexuality, and it's not exploitative. It's not gratuitous. It is simply an expression of who these people are. And that's part of what makes this movie, I think, really singular and unusual.
And does he have some kind of political message here? As you said, it's set during the Cold War. These are a bunch of outsiders.
Oh, definitely, because you have, you know, Sally Hawkins is a mute figure. Octavia Spencer is black. Richard Jenkins' character is gay. And it's people who have been on the fringes or who have been disenfranchised who take back power to overthrow the man.
And then, Michael Shannon is effectively playing the bad guy, and he's kind of the representative of the classic nuclear family. Mm-hmm. But he's unhappy with it, so he's got his own problems. There are a lot of questions of family and how family is depicted.
And it has dance sequences.
It has a dance sequence.
Gorgeous, gorgeous, like classic movie references visually, and just the scenes they recreate. It's really lovely.
Sally Hawkins' character lives above a movie theater. Mm. And so even as the film begins, you're just kind of going through these hallways that have cans of film prints sort of along the sides. And there's a bit in which the creature finds himself watching a movie. and it's just, you know, so it's Guillermo's expression of love for cinema. And for
so
the,
for
that
Creature of the Black Lagoon and that kind of those movies.
Yes, exactly.
Of
yeah.
The scary creatures that came out of World War II movies, mm-hmm. like Godzilla and all that.
I spoke to Doug Jones a couple of weeks ago, and he told me about how when Guillermo was young, he kind of developed a crush on both the creature and the woman in the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh.
And how young Guillermo basically did kind of early fanfic, like this drawings of those two characters, like holding hands, going through a field, or
aww.
Just kind of hanging
aww.
Out. And so this movie is a very obvious extension of that
it's
fandom.
Like Frankenstein.
It is.
Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, see it on the biggest screen you can find.
Next up, Tribes of Palos Verdes. This stars Jennifer Garner. It's about a family that moves to Palos Verdes to make a fresh start. Here's a clip.
We are going to be surrounded by beauty. So make this our home and fill it with memories.
I know.
Wow, Mom.
I feel like Peter Pan.
You have the face you deserve after 30.
You're beautiful. And when the time comes, I know plenty of doctors,
oh,
if that's
God,
what you
Dad,
want.
Really?
Okay, so the dad likes himself some plastic surgery.
The dad is a very arrogant and philandering heart surgeon himself. And so it's about this family, and they move from Michigan to Palos Verdes, and they are shocked by just how different it is visually. And they live in this incredible cliffside home overlooking the water, overlooking surfers. And it's how in this idyllic place, their family falls apart. And it seems like the cliche kind of guilty pleasure, rich, sad, white people story. Mm-hmm. It's based on a book by Joy Nicholson, which came out a long time ago and is finally making its way to the screen. But it's really beautifully shot, and there's a very vivid sense of place. And it's a vision of Southern California, of Los Angeles, that we don't always see. I mean, if you go down to Palos Verdes, it's like a whole other planet. It's so removed from your idea of Hollywood and L.A., and Micah Monroe is the star of this. She's a teenage daughter who finds her escape in surfing, and her brother finds his escape in drugs. And Jennifer Garner gives this really big, showy performance, very uncharacteristically kind of dark and angry from her. She's usually kind of perky and like.
And she's the mom who has to hold it together when the dad leaves.
The pill popping mom who gets depressed and like, you know, hangs out in her robe all day. But it all sounds like they're cliches, but it's so beautifully acted and it's so beautifully shot, kind of vivid and dreamy, gauzy look at beach life. These two brothers, Brendan and Emmett Malloy, directed it, and they've done a lot of music videos, and it just has a really lovely sense of place, and it's well acted. And maybe it falls apart a bit in the third act, but it was surprisingly good given that it just seems like guilty pleasure cliched material.
Okay, let us move on to guilty pleasure. I, Tanya. Maybe not guilty. No guilt here. Starring Margot Robbie as Tanya Harding, the figure skating star who became quite the tabloid scandal in the 1990s. Here's a clip.
My entire life, I've been told I wouldn't amount to anything. You know what? Maybe I would. Never could believe the
things you do to me. 4.8.
How do I get a fair shot here?
We also judge on presentation.
Suck my...
Okay. Dot, dot, dot. Russ, okay, for those of us who don't know the backstory.
Yes. Okay. So I, Tanya, is the story of Tanya Harding, who was a skating prodigy. She began skating at 3, and she was brash. She was unconventional. So she kind of became a champion, but never found a way to fit in. She was always rejected by the skating community, and we see her kind of crawl almost to the top, and then she is involved in what they call the incident, in which her bodyguard takes it upon himself to destroy the career of a rival skater, Nancy Kerrigan.
That was cut on tape when she was kneecapped in real life.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing.
Pretty incredible.
A wild thing that happened, and she professed that she didn't know anything about it, and I believe that. But it was all kind of orchestrated by her husband, who was abusive, and this very Coen Brothers-esque sort of bodyguard who thinks he's a secret agent, basically.
But the thing that I love about this movie is that, yeah, you can say you believe her, but part of the fun of the structure of the script is that it's these dueling, unreliable narrators. And there's Craig Gillespie, who directed it, takes kind of an affectionately mocking look at them all, whether it's Allison Janney as her mother, who just tears it up as her horribly abusive mother, or Robbie herself, or Sebastian Stan as Jeff Galooly. And I keep calling it this. It's Goodfellas on ice. It is darkly funny, and it's often very, very dark, and it has a great energy about it. But you walk away with this really unexpected sense of sympathy for Tanya Harding, because you see what she had to overcome in her home life. Her mother abused her whole life. Her husband abused her. She did not have the money to have the beautiful skating dresses, and so she had to make her own, and she tried so hard, and the judges still marked her down because she didn't project the kind of image of the skating star that they wanted. And, you know, she could do a triple axel, which to this day, like, a handful of people can land cleanly.
She was the first woman to do that, right?
The first U.S. woman, yeah. And now, even now, like, Mariah Nagasu can do it. Not a lot of skaters can do it. And Margot Robbie is amazing. And when she was first cast, I thought, she's too traditionally stunningly beautiful to play Tanya Harding. But she really just digs into the role. It's a physical role. There's a swagger to her, but also a vulnerability to her. And I loved it. This is way high on my top 10 list. It's like number 3 on my top 10 list for the year.
What did you think?
I'm less taken with it. It's an interesting thing because I think that all of these ingredients are fantastic. Margot Robbie is incredible. Mm-hmm. Allison Janney as her mom, every moment is like watching concrete harden. She's immovable and she's terrible, and Janney is great. I don't think the movie treats Tanya Harding very well. She has this constant refrain in this movie: it's not my fault. It wasn't my fault. And she does all these things that aren't exactly her fault, but she's fighting so hard against this system that she undermines herself. And I think the movie undermines her a little bit because...
Is it laughing at her?
I don't think so.
I think it tries not to, and it's very energetic, and I think sometimes it goes for energy rather than empathy, and I find it to falter in that way.
I found it surprisingly sympathetic toward her. Yeah, it shifts as the tone goes on. As you get to know her and get to see what she has gone through, you realize that there's great kindness for her and great appreciation for her. And even now, like, they had the premiere this past week in New York, and Margot Robbie brought Tanya Harding with her as her date on the red carpet. So I feel like there's an embrace of her. Whether or not she actually knew anything, there is a desire to rethink what the narrative has been all this time.
Yeah, and in that respect, I think the movie is terrific. I think this just... the idea to show you what her life was like and what she faced. You know, she just thought, why can't it be about the skating? Everybody constantly tells her it's not just about the skating and it's never going to be. And she fought this battle that she was really doomed to fail. And there's something kind of wonderful in that, and something
tragic
tragic as well. But I think it's a little glib.
Where are they now, Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding?
Nancy Kerrigan did Dancing with the Stars. And Tanya Harding is a mom. There's a title card at the end that explains where they all are now. And I don't want to say what the title card said for Tanya Harding, but
she was a boxer, right?
She was a boxer. They get into that as well. She did what she had to do to just survive. But the last line in the title card about what Tanya Harding is up to now made me cry. It's so sad. In one line, it's so sad.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, thanks for ending on that note, Christy.
No, but great. Okay. But great. No, but good.
Okay. Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube, and Russ Fisher is film critic and editor-in-chief of MoviePilot.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how 40s film star Hedy Lamarr was secretly a scientist. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In the 1930s and 40s, actress Hedy Lamarr was called the most beautiful woman in the world.
And he said, oh, I've loved her in movies. Since I can remember, the most beautiful woman in motion.
She's really a knockout.
Yeah, and that's the way I feel, too. We'll all see her together. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Miss Hedy Lamarr.
These days, she's mostly remembered for her looks and glamour more than for her films. A pretty face from the golden age of Hollywood. But off screen, Lamarr was much more interesting and complicated than her image suggests. When she wasn't acting, she was an amateur inventor and even came up with a communication system that later became the basis for secure Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and GPS. A new documentary called Bombshell explores Hedy Lamarr's life. Alexandra Dean is the director, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. I did not know that the iconic image of Snow White, Disney's Snow White, was based on Hedy Lamarr. So that tells you just what an icon she was, right?
Yes. I mean, that's a little controversial, I should tell you. There are a few different actresses that were definitely influencing Snow White. But Hedy's look, which was on billboards everywhere in advance of her first big feature when Snow White was being finished off, apparently inspired the very pale skin and dark hair of Snow White. And actually, I look at Snow White and I totally see Hedy from that period. It's striking.
Yeah. She was born in Vienna and she married at age 19. Tell us about her upbringing. How did she grow up?
She grew up in a really upper middle class family with a father who was a banker. She was an only child. She had, you know, lots of luxury around her, she used to like to say. And it was all lost because she was from a Jewish family, an assimilated Jewish family. And her childhood was really leading up to the early 30s when we know what happened in Austria. The Nazis invade and, you know, a lot of the people that she knew and loved were lost.
Mm. But before that happened, she had made quite a name for herself early on as an actress. She acted in a very scandalous movie at the time.
Yes. Hedy really burst onto the world scene with this incredibly, very beautiful, I think, an artsy film called Ecstasy, but incredibly scandalous.
The Pope denounced it and Hitler refused it to be shown. People were just shocked by it.
Ecstasy was the first film to show, you know, a woman in the throes of orgasm, if and we can say that on radio.
You can say that on the radio. We're not in the 30s now.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah. Ecstasy, but also not only was she in the throes of orgasm, she was naked.
She ran naked through the woods, you know, and I like to think of it as her Kim Kardashian moment. You know, she was really bold. She was very beautiful and free.
Hmm. And then that attracted the attention of men, obviously, and a certain rich man whom she married when she was very young, 19.
Yeah, she marries this fascinating man who's like the Henry Ford of Austria, except he's an arms manufacturer instead of making cars, and he ends up allied with the Nazis. It's kind of accidental because he himself is Jewish, but he was supporting another faction of the fascists that were not anti-Semitic and ends up roped into the fascist party and ends up with his father in a concentration camp, and the Nazis get to tell him whatever they want him to do because he doesn't want his father to die.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Mm. And so Hedy, though, she's what now, the wife of a rich man, and is she feeling kind of constrained by that?
Yeah, she said time and again that being married to him at the age of 19 as a rising actress was like being a beautiful bird in a golden cage. This is the extraordinary thing. She had a genius for escape as much as she had a genius for invention, and she escapes him in the middle of the night. It's this very dramatic escape, and ends up on a boat with Louis B. Mayer and convinces Mayer to make her another, you know, one of the big actresses in his stable of stars.
And just describe how huge she was at that time.
She was an Angelina Jolie, and it was really her look she was known for. She never had that big breakout film. She turned down Casablanca, but she turned down Laura, so she never had a big hit.
And here's what's remarkable. After a grueling day on the set, Hedy didn't go to bed. She wasn't socializing. Hedy was at home working on her latest invention.
And in the 1940s, World War II is raging. The United States is now in it. And she feels patriotic that America saved her. So she wants to help. And so describe how she decides how she wants to help.
Well, her invention was something called frequency hopping. And the fascinating thing about frequency hopping is it is in our secure communications today. Some forms of Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GPS, cell phones still use it, even military satellites that, you know, are used for the most secure communication there is, use her invention. And the reason that it's interesting is that it was really a problem that came out of the Second World War when a ship might try to control a remote control torpedo with one radio signal, and it was very vulnerable. It was easy to jam. The military was worrying about any remote control of their gadgets or weaponry being hacked by the enemy, and this was a way to avoid it.
So previously, a signal would be sent on one channel, and then the Germans could just jam that channel. And
that's
then
right.
She came up with this idea that the frequency could be on multiple channels at once. And so if you tried to jam it, you could jam maybe one of the channels, but then the rest would get through.
That's right. Frequency hopping. You hop from frequency to frequency very, very fast. That was her great idea.
And how did she come
up
with that?
And that is what we still use. Well, she came up with it together with a concert pianist named George Antheil. And what's really fascinating about their collaboration is that neither of them had a college or an advanced degree. They'd both left school before they finished high school. And we do get into how exactly they came up with this invention in the film. We did sort of figure it out, and we do unpack it for you, but it's very intuitive.
And so she has this idea, this invention, that could really help in the war against the Germans, because the Germans are succeeding in the water, at least with their submarines. And what does she do when she presents this idea to the military?
When she presents the idea to the military, they completely misunderstand it. They think because it's being presented by a musician and by a movie star that these guys don't really know what they're talking about. And so they dismiss it out of hand. And the famous comment that George says that the Navy said to him was, "What do you want to do, put a player piano inside a torpedo?"
And then what did they do with the invention, with the patent?
The invention was forgotten, which was devastating to Hedy.
So did anyone else come up with this idea of frequency hopping?
You know, it's interesting. Inventions generally tend to appear around the world at the same time, with many different brilliant minds coming at the problem from many different angles. And that is the case with frequency hopping. But nobody has the kind of solution that Hedy came up with. And nobody else can trace a direct line the way we can with her invention to the military technology that the U.S. would later use, and then to what goes into our Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and cell phones today.
So who or how was it dusted off then, and how was it later used in our modern technology?
Well, I think you should watch the documentary to find out exactly how it suddenly reemerges. But it's this one man who decides to give her credit.
Did she ever get any money for that?
Hedy never got money or recognition for what she did, except for a little bit of acknowledgement right at the end of her life, which was really too little too late.
The Navy, Milstark, and Lockheed Martin actually gave Hedy an award thanking her for coming up with her idea. And when I called her, I said, Mom, they're going to give you an award. But she just didn't want to be seen.
And so how did her film career end?
Eddie's film career was really shaped by this struggle she had with Louis B. Mayer. And in the end, she decided to strike out on her own. And she and Bette Davis are the real pioneers of actors and actresses starting their own production companies.
But she wasn't a success.
She wasn't.
She actually, I mean, you portray her as being a prisoner of her face. And actually, she was a prisoner in that she insisted on getting all this plastic surgery towards the end of her life. And even though she didn't want to be known as just a pretty face, why would she do that?
Yeah, the plastic surgery is very painful to watch. It's really about her inventive mind trying to come up with this solution to the problem of getting older and losing what she perceives as her power in the world. She tries to come up with new inventive plastic surgeries. And she didn't really, you know, she was a pioneer. She didn't know all the ins and outs of plastic surgery the way we do today. And in fact, it turns out you can't sit in the sun with the kind of plastic surgery she was having. And so her face has this melted quality after a while. So
sad. Oh, that's tragic. Yeah. So she becomes almost a monster, in a sense. That here's this gorgeous face, and then it's turned into this other thing.
I look at her and I see this woman who's starting to have real wisdom about the world, starting to come to a realization. And it's funny when I watch it with people, you know, I see this reaction. I see that they are shocked. They're really shocked. And, you know, to me, it's just heady. I guess I got to know her so well that I don't see that monstrousness, but it's apparently there.
But was that why she became a recluse, that she didn't want people to see her face?
Yeah, definitely. She didn't want people to see her.
And did she miss being out in the world and being with other people?
You know, she was very present on the telephone. She would call people all the time. And she had that relationship with them on the phone.
They think I'm a bad actress. I think sometimes in life I act more than on the screen.
She couldn't come out of her house because she didn't want to reveal who she'd become.
Hmm. Wow, that is really sad.
Yeah.
This documentary has come out. Do you think that this will in some way rehabilitate her?
I hope so. I think so. I think the world is ready to hear her story and to celebrate her in all her complicated glory. And I think, you know, I really hope she kind of takes her place in the pantheon of great inventors.
And what about seeing her movies? Would you recommend one to watch?
I would recommend Ecstasy. I think it's beautiful. And, you know, it's not that scandalous today. I think Algiers, her first film where she burst onto the scene in the United States, is really beautiful as well. And it contains this scene of her that apparently made the audiences gasp at how beautiful she was when she first appeared.
This all reminds me when I was a kid. We used to dance in the streets on holidays, New Year's, 1st of May.
14th of July.
How do you know?
What do you think I was doing?
Too bad you weren't in my neighborhood, Rue de la Bruyère.
Rue de la Bruyère?
That's where I live.
I went to school on the hill.
It was almost next door to me.
No.
And then, you know, I love Jimmy Stewart and I love Come Live With Me, this lovely little comedy they did together. So those are my three recommendations.
Okay. And here's a fourth recommendation, Bombshell. It's at the New Art on Friday. Alexandra Dean is the director. It's a new documentary about the life of Hedy Lamarr. Alexandra Dean, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Christian Bordahl is here now. Hello.
Here with my own bombshell.
Okay, let's hear it.
Which is KCRW listeners, not big fans of LeVar Ball.
I'm shocked.
You are?
I'm shocked.
LeVar says all three sons are going to be Lakers.
Right.
Scott Matthews says maybe as ball boys.
Ba-dum-bum.
Ba-dum-bum. Shannon Sish, or Kish, says, I'm a Bruin and I'm happy he took his kid out of school. Don't come back. We don't need ball family drama. Nancy Foster says his sideshow is getting sadder and sadder by the day. These boys are so messed up already. What a shame they don't get a chance to see a college environment. Seraphim Consekau says LeVar is loud, obnoxious, and over the top, but he's opened a lot of eyes. He's showing other parents of exceptional athletes that the road to the NBA does not have to go through the NCAA.
Okay, well, lots of comments on the Ball family drama. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And thank you all for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.